should go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
My truth is the truth that you will never understand.
Private ownership is one single individual giving green light. Doesn't that tell you that your system is more akin to authoritarian dictatorship?
And now we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
What the heck is a deed? How come he can buy our house when it's our house and we live there?
Just when these American citizens needed their rights the most, their government took them away. And rights aren't rights if someone could take them away.
They have every man in a straitjacket. To leave a country is like breaking out of jail. And to enter a country is like going through the eye of a needle.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
Shout out! Revolution!
Police Academy essentially opens up policing to the citizens. It's a pretty anarchic idea for an 80s movie.
We're not only going on strike, but we need to fire the bosses. This whole you getting paid more, doing less work thing, it's not working out, Steve.
Okay, welcome to the live edition of the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt. If you are listening to us live, whether via the stream or via your electronic box of radio, this is the Three Left Show, your two-hour leftist news magazine, where I discuss various topics that interest me and might just interest you as well, kind of unreported. I basically take a lot of different stories, long and short, and tie them together with a theme, actually explore a topic more fully. Today's topic, I cycle back to ecology, three flags, and one of them is ecology. So I talk about environmentalist stuff, though there is kind of a difference between environmentalism and ecology. Environmentalism is where one has this predisposition about saving the environment, protecting the environment, treating it as a commodity, an object, a thing that is separate from us. But I do not do that. But at the very least, in the opening parts of this program, I'm going to be talking about solving climate change and fighting climate or harm reduction of climate change, or just making ourselves less fossil fuel dependent, less pollution dependent, in a tech-focused way, as many sources do, that there's this tech utopianism on the horizon, that there are these technical engineering solutions. That's why all of our kids have been and should get STEM degrees, no artists need be made, less profitable, no good incomes, no living wages for them if they're artists. That needs to change. It's a problem of priorities as well as who is rewarded and who isn't. And it should be a clue that if STEM fields are so much more needed, capitalists want more STEM and engineering majors. Why do they want engineers and not artists? Not ecologists, not environmentalists. Why aren't they valued by the market? These are questions to ask. And I need to adjust this. I'm live streaming. Go to Facebook, Three Left Show, if you want to catch a live stream. Okay, our first story is from the Washington Post, Voice of the Oligarchy, owned by Jeff Bezos. But this is an opinion piece, so it's something else, I guess. But it is an introduction to the topic today. It's called For the Love of Earth, Stop Traveling. So it's focused on those individual choices it actually kind of mentions amidst this in the opening paragraph. It's written by Jack Miles, published 2 years ago in November. Jack Miles, a Pulitzer Prize and MacArthur Genius Award-winning author, was a contributor to UCalifornia's Bending the Curve report on climate stability. His forthcoming book is called God in the Quran. So according to UN climate chief Cristina Figueres, we have only 3 years left, and this was in 2017, by the way, in which to bend the emissions curve downward and forestall a terrifying cascade of climate-related catastrophes, which are actually occurring today. Much worse than what we're already experiencing, realistically, is there anything that you or I can do as individuals to make a significant difference in the short time remaining? Now, as a leftist, I would say, no, we need collective solutions, we need to act collectively. Now, usually you do that for the state, so you need that state intervention. But collective intervention can also mean neighborhood action and social movements. But this guy, writing for the Washington Post, said the answer is yes, and the good news is it won't cost us a penny. It will actually save us money, and we won't, and you can tell this is from a place of privilege because guess what? Not everyone travels by plane, but he is talking to an audience, as the Washington Post audience is, the ruling class, or rather upper middle class people, people who fly by plane regularly. It will actually save us money, and we won't have to leave home to do it. Staying home, in fact, is the essence in making a big difference in a big hurry, forestalling anyone who actually can't leave home. That's because nothing that we do pumps carbon dioxide in the atmosphere faster than air travel. Cancel a couple of long flights, and you can have your carbon footprint. Schedule a couple, and you can double or triple that carbon footprint. Atmosphere, nice name, is a German public interest group that recommends limiting your air travel to around 3,100 miles per year. If you live in LA, as this guy must do, that's a round-trip flight to Mexico City. If you must exceed that limit, Atmosphere invites you to compensate by sending conscious money on a prorated basis to support climate stabilization efforts. So again, this is pretty neoliberal in that you can buy your way to a clean conscience as far as your energy use. But that's not really how morality works. Sorry. That's kind of why we have a Christian Reformation and reforms. And we kind of need to reform capitalism if you're going to take that route and say that, no, you actually have to use less energy, less air travel, which is, you know, where this the thesis of this is. So he mentions that he had an invitation to speak in Morocco. I used this online calculator to, and he links it, to determine the carbon cost of my trip. My seats alone on the round trip flight from LA to Casablanca, with a layover in Paris, helped emit about 8,400 pounds of carbon dioxide, prorated into the atmosphere. Double that because my wife accompanied me. In sum, our seats alone on the plane to and from Morocco helped unload 16,800 pounds of carbon dioxide. This, of course, was just a small fraction of the emissions cost of the flight as a whole. To put this into perspective, him and his wife's annual carbon footprint in Orange County, California, counting their gas use, electricity, and transportation and their waste, is 33,000 pounds. Which means that according to this calculator, oh yeah, and he also compares that to the average Indian's annual carbon footprint of 3,000 pounds. So a tenth or 11th of that of what one Orange County resident, or rather an upper class or an upper middle class Orange County resident. But taking one optional international trip that helped emit that much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, my wife and I increased their 2016 footprint by more than a third. The harm we did with one international trip surely neutralized any good we did all year as recyclers, eco-consumers, and financial contributors to environmental organizations. Doing all that good individual liberal stuff, making a big difference. But that's his point. By just taking one international plane trip, he basically, yeah, did in fact cancel all of that out, which kind of either speaks to how little impact all of those individualist things do, as well as just how costly to the global climate and our environment that our modern civilization actually has those costs. To put our flights further in perspective, the average American generates 1,300 pounds of carbon dioxide through beef consumption, eating meat. Minute by minute, mile by mile, nothing we do causes greater or more easily avoidable harm to the environment than flying, which more often than not is optional or merely recreational. The delegates meeting in Bonn, Germany next week, this is in 2017 again, for the UN Climate Conference, called the COP23, it's the 23rd one. The organizers note, a lion's share of their greenhouse gas emissions themselves come from the long-distance air travel. After the conference, the COP23 Sustainability Task Force will tally up the overall footprint of the conference and seek to offset as much as possible by buying certified emission reduction credits. So, more buying and consumption is apparently the solution. I do not agree with that. Many of which will go to green development projects in small island states in recognition of Fiji holding the presidency of this conference. Oh, how nice of them. As if that shouldn't just be done in the first place. But no, it has to be done to offset the harms of the Europeans or the, you know, the oppressor states, let's call them. Maybe that's something to keep in mind of, like, we should be spending things on the social good, not because to morally assuage the middle class's spending and consumption, but because that's the just thing to do. He points out there are 7 billion people on this planet. It's close to 7.5 now. But the billion with the largest carbon footprint includes the most frequent flyers. I belong to that top billion. So do many of you. He's speaking to his audience. If all 7 billion had a carbon footprint as large as ours, global carbon dioxide emissions would increase from the current 38 billion tons to... Basically, if everyone actually flew around like Americans do, we would be soaking the atmosphere with carbon. So in his book, or report, Bending the Curve, published in 2015, that trillion tons would translate into a catastrophic spike in global warming, an increase in 33 degrees Fahrenheit every 7 years. So maybe that's maybe you haven't heard what 1 degree Celsius rise doesn't sound like a lot, but it means 33 degrees higher temperature on average very quickly, 7 years. So for the love of Earth, our common home, and not only our home, but everyone else's, start conducting more remote work meetings, training sessions virtually. Inform those jet-setting friends that you won't attend their destination wedding in the tropics. You'll send a gift in the mail. Or at least in the early planning stages, suggest they not do that. You know, because it has to be collective. It can't just be your individual choice. Oh, no, I'm not going to go. It has to be a movement. It has to be a movement to say, okay, if we're going to the tropics, it's by boat. Sailboat. Start taking vacations by train or car, as I do. I'm going to be taking a train through my vacation next month. Start taking vacations by, and by the way, I did a long distance. I did a 2-day train trip to Texas. I'm in New York. And it was pretty pleasant. Not so much on the way back, but only because I got sick. Explain to your ecological public interest group that the Galapagos will be much better off without you. So he must travel in circles where, the environmental groups he's giving to must have yearly or regular, sub-regular trips to South America, eco-tourist stuff. To remind them that there's a world out there. They need to be reminded. They have to see it with their own eyes. And please, all you professionals bouncing between New York and Washington, these must be friends of his, take a train, not a plane. And then he reads a excerpt from a poem. I don't care about that. And then kind of says, take a deep breath, throw away that bucket list for good. Again, he's referring to upper middle class people who have bucket lists of traveling here and traveling there. You are needed at home, my friend, urgently needed. For the love of the earth and for those who inherit it when you are gone, stay right where you are. Now, this, to me, leads into an argument for kind of regionalism, that traveling is just fine, but you got to travel within a regional network, and then you travel from network to network, usually by a train or bus, and trust me, it is much better. So, next story is from Vice Motherboard. It's going to be two stories. They're linked together. They're actually listed on the same page. It's very convenient. Convenience will appear again in this discussion, this episode, quite often. Convenience versus what is just, and where do they intersect? So this is a study. Again, it's called Decentralized Microgridding Can Provide 90% of a Neighborhood's Energy Needs, study finds. So it's a new approach that could pave the way for 100% net zero self-sufficiency in all things, not only power, but heat and water. Written by Nafees Ahmed, published September of last year. Before, it doesn't explain what microgrids are in the first place. So we have a power grid. A power grid is a vast piece of infrastructure where you have centralized power plants, or whether it be even if it's renewable, it'll be a very large solar array, a very large wind farm, offshore or onshore. And that is the grid. So a microgrid is just a smaller version of that. Where it's more regional, more local, maybe on the size of a town. In this case, it's going to talk about on the scale of a neighborhood, where you have, instead of individualizing it where everyone needs to have their own power system, their own set of solar panels. Not everyone's roof is good for that. So there can be community power plants where you take some vacant lots and then you fill them with solar panels and they produce enough for the neighborhood. So that, in essence, is a microgrid. But a microgrid also means, or particularly in this context, means that you have, let's say, half of a neighborhood with solar panels, the ones that have good roofs and maybe could afford them in the first place. Their power is feeding into the grid constantly, especially in the summertime. And it's almost a surplus. And they're certainly making more power than they're using. So either that is waste, or it should go into the grid and then be used by someone else. And currently, as it's centralized, the central power distributor in New York, that's National Grid, PUE, they have a monopoly. I mean, they're a public service entity, but they are also a corporation because it was privatized. Yay. They basically pay any excess energy you make and is put into the grid. They send you a check. But that's on a vast scale, and the infrastructure some usually can't take doing that. There's a lot of barriers to doing that well because it's a vast, large, cumbersome network. So a new report funded by the Dutch government finds that microgrid tech could become a local techno-economy, 90% self-sufficient, through the decentralized sharing of energy at the local level between multiple households. The new approach could even pave the way for 100% self-sufficiency in power and else in all things and food production, according to a report's author, a man whose last name is Graf. If optimized properly, microgrids can play a pivotal role in supporting efforts to transition to renewables and meet climate targets. Finds the report published in the Netherlands energy company Metabolic. The report was funded by the Dutch Ministry of Economic Affairs, as well as the Netherlands Enterprise Agency. So Dutch government gives money to energy company to look into just how good microgrids could be. And most likely, maybe there's a conflict of interest. Metabolic deals in creating these microgrid systems. But under the Paris Agreement, the Dutch government's pledged to drop its carbon dioxide emissions, and just that, not pollution in general, but at least carbon dioxide, to 80-95% by 2050. And that's the thing. You need to drop all greenhouse gas emissions. That includes methane and such. So you could, like, lower carbon dioxide emissions, but then raise your methane emissions, which is worse. That's kind of what natural gas does. Reaching the goal will require extraordinary level of effort by any standard, but the use of microgrids, which means decentralized grids, that intelligently balance the local supply and demand of distributed clean energy resources, you know, what solar panels make, could avoid the need for massive spending on infrastructure upgrades. So this uses the language of smart grids and being smart. Now, I prefer to turn that around and say we do not need smart tech in smart cities, we need smart people. But that said, the point here is a decentralized grid, which requires people to be smarter, to be more autonomous, to not depend on central authorities. That can be abusive. Authoritarian. According to a new report, titled New Strategies for Smart Integrated Decentralized Energy Systems, by 2050, almost half of all EU households will produce renewable energy. We're way behind that. Of these, so this is like a report, like the microgrids come in once you kind of have a base of local energy production. Now, we're slowly getting there, but that momentum may have been blocked by the Trump administration because you can't leave it up to markets. Markets weren't doing it, so there needed to be incentives by the state. As time progresses, costs go down and the climate awareness goes up, more and more people start owning one or more of these technologies. So, okay, the report describes microgrids as the end result of a combination of several trends, tech trends, namely rooftop solar, electric vehicles, heat pumps, which I may need to explain. A heat pump is referring to putting a pipe into the ground, because below ground, underground, the temperature is always around 55 to 60 degrees, meaning in the summer, you can pipe up cold air by pumping water through these pipes. And you can even heat up water from freezing to 55 degrees and then heat it up with, you have less to go. So that's a heat pump, which is still a heavy investment. as well as batteries for storing this energy. Key is that these technologies are decentralized. They can easily be owned by individual consumers, as well as cooperatives, groups of people in local systems. As time progresses, costs go down. Yeah, okay. Currently, he said, the way in which these technologies, in his words, dumb. Ooh. We simply attach solar panels, heat pumps, and electric vehicles to the grid for their own separate purposes. An individual purpose. This dramatically increases the load on the local grid, requiring costly infrastructure to sustain that system. This is where the Metabolic Report called SIDE systems come in. SIDE is an acronym for Smart Integrated Decentralized Energy. So the full list includes hydrogen cells, electric boilers, wood stoves, electric heating itself, biodigesters, put food waste in, gas comes out, wind turbines, hot water tanks, etc., etc. This integration should be done through an intelligent energy management system, which will charge your vehicle when the sun is shining, export excess electricity to your neighbor's heat pump. This is what a smart grid means. Ultimately, this smart decentralized integration democratizes energy production and consumption, but then puts the control of it into an automated system, which seems like a contradiction to me, and allows consumers and cooperatives to take control of their own energy supply. And he's also, the language of this report, or at least graph here, is that he's assuming any new enterprise will be a cooperative, which is just great. Notice he's not using the word company, firm, corporation, small business. So this is also called an earthship model, at least when it's an individual house. So an earthship is usually made of recycled, locally sourced, low-impact construction materials. An earthship's design, it's basically a form of a house. A house that is completely net zero energy use and self-sufficient. So it's usually made up of two elements, a cave and a greenhouse. So you kind of build like a cave, a house that's really insulated, heavily, like thick walls, not a lot of windows. It's like a cave. But let's say you made out of like rammed earth tires or just many layers of things like wood. And then you build a greenhouse attached to that cave, which then passively heats that cave in the winter. And then you can open things up, and that cave is a cooler space in the summer. The report found that Azrazaelin's energy system was overall significantly cheaper in the long run than a conventional grid-powered. And this is, Azrazaelin is an Earthship eco-village, which includes all the things listed, those side systems. The report's simulated, so this is still a model, a projection, that would happen if Azrazaelin implemented this intelligent managed microgrid. So they don't have one currently. Each of its houses in this village, this collection, this grouping of houses, they all generate their own energy and food, but not like they're not sharing intelligently. They're dumb, which I'm not totally on board with describing it that way. But connecting all the houses together so that if one is making more than another, then that access is shared. That's cool. These would entail a whole suite of interconnected technologies like battery storage, and I'm emphasizing certain techs because I'm going to kind of pull them apart later. Smart meters, which actively monitor what's in the system, air-to-water heat pumps, so on. I'm not going to bore you. All these case studies, Aderheisen, showed the most promise, reaching almost fully, that's 89% self-sufficient, feasible energy system. Applying this model means that entirely possible to overcome the current incapacity of grid infrastructure, massive centralized grid, which in the Netherlands can handle the input of only a quarter of the intermittent, meaning renewable energy that's put in. Using side systems, this percentage can be increased to more than half to 75. And he talks about how it's even smarter, so you could have smart hoods, as Graf calls them. The project aims to design an urban system which integrates decentralized food, water, energy in order to create a nearly fully self-sufficient neighborhood. It works based on a principle that he calls circularity, recycling water, materials, and waste as much as possible. So recycling and reuse very important, right? But I'm uncomfortable with it still depending on these high-end technologies that are very expensive. It says the price can go lower, but what does it mean when tech price goes lower? What does that take? As it ends, the simulations demonstrate the potential viability of this model. The next step, which DeGraaf and his team are working on now, is to execute it on the ground in the Netherlands to encourage neighborhoods around the world to take it up. It says that living in a smart hood, where it does all of that, instantly reduces one's ecological footprint to near 40%. I think the rest might come in the form of individual like lifestyle. But I think there's just the embodied energy in making all the tech. It's not zero, because it's not all made of naturally occurring resources. And that's where we get into the next story, linked. It's literally the same page. The editor of this must have been, this must be conscious, because it's something I would do, where you basically set up like, oh, we could have net zero neighborhoods if we has to have all the smart technology with batteries and hydrogen cells. Well, here's some hard reality for you. Next title is, we do not mine enough rare earth minerals to replace fossil fuels with renewable energy. Now, this could be one of those steel man arguments that a conservative makes. There's no point in switching to renewables. We just don't have the actual literal resources to. But then that's an argument for using less everything, reducing everything, saying our economy can't depend on growth anymore since we can't keep polluting our environment and growing with energy use that is polluting and dirty. And since we can't grow with renewable energy and switch our entire economy to it, then the answer is to cut back, not just the flying for the upper class and just how wasteful our entire economy is down to every level. But then it's not an individual's fault anymore because the supply chain is not democratically controlled. So, a subtitle is, rare earth minerals are used in solar panels and wind turbines, at least the ones that depend on using electromagnets and such, as well as electric cars and consumer electronics. We don't recycle them, and there's not enough to meet growing demand as we extract them from the earth. This is written by Nafiz Ahmed, published December of last year. So similarly, like the last story, this is a scientific study supported by the Dutch Ministry, the Dutch Government of Infrastructure, that warns that renewable energy industry could be about to face a fundamental obstacle, shortages in the supply of rare metals. To meet greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets under the Paris Agreement, the one that Trump dropped but was pretty teethless in the first place, but at least countries like the Netherlands take it seriously. This means that global production are several rare earth minerals used in solar panels and wind turbines. They do not have to be, by the way, but as far as industrial production is concerned, they're the best. Especially, and here's some some words for you, niobium, terbium, inobium, dysprosium, and praseodymium. The production of these metals must grow 12-fold by 2050 if we're actually going to meet those. We'll have 80% or 50% renewable energy by 2050, which is the New York target, and it's proposed by other liberals. And they seem completely unaware, as they are, that there's this lack of actual like ability to do that without seriously restructuring the economy, which is the fear of many conservatives and naysayers. And so in some ways, in that way, they're right. We do need to restructure. It will change everything. So it is a lie to say, like, look, we don't actually have to change everything. We just have to switch out the dirty energy for the clean energy. No, it's not as simple as that. Other metals include, on the lower scale, silver. You might know what that is. So according to the study by Dutch Energy Systems Company, and so it's again metabolic. So I think this whole page must be like supported by them or something. But this is it is real information here. I'm creating a reality with it. Post-truth. The study focuses on demand for rare metals in the Netherlands itself, but extrapolates this to develop the picture of how global trends are likely to develop. If the rest of the world would develop renewable electricity capacity at a comparable pace, a considerable shortage would arise. This doesn't include other applications of rare earth metals in other electronics industries. It's just talking about energy. But since we want everyone to have a smartphone, when other applications such as electric vehicles are also taken into consideration, the required amount of certain metals would further increase. Demand for rare earths is pitched to rise exponentially across the world, and not just due to renewables. Demand is most evident in consumer electronics, military applications, we need it for war, and other technical equipment in industrial applications. The growth of global middle class from 1 to 3 billion people will only further accelerate this. Middle class being like having status symbols like a smartphone or a car. But the study does not account for those other industries. This means that the actual problem could be far more intractable. 2017, study in Nature, so the science magazine, found that a range of minerals essential for smartphones, laptops, cars, and even copper wiring could face supply shortages in the coming decades. The other challenge, rare metals, mining is massively concentrated in a few countries, particularly China, which dominates 80% of this mining and nearly 95% of refining it, although Australia and Turkey are significant other producers. Europe and the U.S. are overwhelmingly dependent on this trade imbalance, which would be in a position to control global supply, a position that could be easily abused. Quote, there might be a certain moment when they prioritize their own renewable production over others. They have been taking a strategic position in getting all of the technological expertise and data around this, said the lead author, Piette von Exter. The good news is that ample identified reserves for this energy transition, so the massive global energy transition, do in fact exist, but the key challenge is the lead time. It takes large capital investments, meaning global corporations, between 10 to 20 years to open new mines. So meaning, we have 10 years to turn things around, you know, to switch our energy production. Well, it's going to take that long just to open the mines, to extract the metal, to switch over the energy grid. So that's pretty much, it'll be too late. As the 2050 kind of goal lines are also kind of too late to reduce the harm of climate change. The timeline needs to be 2030. And so it really has to be a matter of less. We had to just cut the economy in half almost. But that's not doable. So it's something to think about. So it tries to find some cop-outs to an extent. One solution is to find viable substitutions for rare metals. This holds some promise, but could also shift the burden to other metals. Another solution is for Europe and other countries to revitalize domestic mining industry using new tech that can reduce their energy and water footprint. Right. This could still be costly, and domestic reserves aren't ample enough to rival those of China, though. So then it goes to where I would go. The key, then, is to have a circular economy, a regenerative approach that doesn't rely on just extracting more, but designed to minimize resource input and waste by implementing principles in design, maintenance, repair, and recycling. As the Metabolic founder Eva Godlek says, it is essential for us to manage materials in a circular fashion in order to ensure that we have enough to actually have a low-carbon future. Currently, however, recycling rates, and I've covered this in previous episodes, are critical metals are below 1%. That's the recycling rate for these metals. And some rare earth metals aren't recycled at all. If that practice continues, critical supply bottlenecks will be inevitable. Unless a circular strategy is implemented, the industry will remain completely reliant on mining for its raw material supply. To make recycling the dominant source of raw material, very high recycling rates are then needed. To succeed, the renewable energy industry needs to embrace a circular economy, as we all do. That's my words. If it doesn't, the report authors told me This could drastically delay the energy transition, a disruption which we cannot afford in the race against climate change, which it's already happening, my dudes. But I got a great clip for you. That was Sam Sparrow with Recycle It. boys, finally have a use for that audio track. Okay, so I have a story from The Times. I do not have a subscription. Please go to my Patreon and become a member. I don't have extra material for you, okay? No special bonuses for being a member, sorry. I'm okay with the amount I'm making. I'm not putting up any walls between you and it. I don't want to commodify my work. And I also don't make enough. But I can at least, since I don't have a subscription, at least read the first paragraph. And it's called Congo's Miners Dying in Hell Tunnels to Power Your Mobile. Exploited by Japanese firms, workers as young as 9 risk their lives to feed the world's glowing hunger for cobalt. So this isn't such a rare metal, but to get any kind of metal, it's got to be mined. And this is what I mean by those costs. Human frickin' costs. So Lange Kelani sits on her broken orange sofa, heavily pregnant, resting. Looking around her 3-room shack, she wonders how she will feed her 8 children. Her husband died in a mining accident 10 days ago. She has never held an iPhone and has no idea what an electric car is. But when the deep, muddy tunnel collapsed on her husband, he was digging for a commodity that is critical to the batteries of both. Cobalt. Last year, around 70% of the world's supply came from the Congo, with its monikers Democratic Republic of. One of the poorest, most violent, and corrupt places on Earth, much of its cobalt comes from around this town. Without the DR Congo, there is no electric car industry, no green revolution. Without this kind of exploitation, without this kind of mining. Now, I don't have the rest of the story, but I encourage you to seek it out, and maybe I'll find something similar, as there could be other reporting, and there should be way more reporting. I mean, this should be mainstream news. You know, the battery in your phone comes from slave labor, or near slave labor, in the Congo. Like conflict diamonds, but, oh, I don't have buy conflict diamonds. Well, you do buy electronics, right? And so, and the blasé nature of politics in America, I actually watched, at least with commentary, running commentary, the Democratic debate, and one of the candidates mentioned this, like, you know, we're going to, I think it was actually Elizabeth Warren, like, we're going to build 2 million electric cars, and they need to be made in America. You know, very popular with the industrialist crowd. But this whole, like, well, first, 2 million cars is not enough to replace any percentage of American car ownership. And I'll get into that later. But I want to point out that it's like cars don't come from nowhere. They got to be made of stuff. Where does the stuff come from? Nobody cares. It's just convenient. Just let it, just have it magically pop into existence. And then bank accounts in Wall Street grow richer. Which goes counter to Elizabeth Warren's rhetoric, which is why I don't take it very seriously. Although it's very nice to hear these things in a nationally syndicated program. It needs to be grounded in the reality that we can't do this socialist stuff unless it's ecological. And what does that actually mean, to be ecological? To not just, this isn't about caring about the environment. I'm making a humanistic argument that if you care about your fellow man, whether you think you're a good Christian or a good Muslim or any kind of spirituality you have or don't have, that we need to think about the supply stream. We need to think about how our economy is organized. That changing it is not going to happen overnight. It's not going to take 10 years, but we need to at least start. We need to take the first baby steps. Or in the next story, also from Wired, motherboard is Vice, but Wired is probably, I think, the same media network as such. In their energy side of things, the title is The Spiraling Environmental Cost of Your Lithium Battery Addiction. As the world scrambles to replace fossil fuels with clean energy, the environmental impact of finding all the lithium required could become a major issue in its own right. So lithium counts as one of those rare metals. So I covered rare earth metals and the general problem. Now let's focus just on one of them and the details. This is lithium. Now, I used a lithium battery yesterday. It was in a weed whacker, a Black & Decker weed whacker. Now, if it was my choice, and I'm requesting the people that I'm gardening with, because it is through a nonprofit entity they just incorporated, and they are getting money, and there's some spending happening, mostly on their programming and outreach. But I requested like sickles and scythes, you know, hand tools that have the same functionality as a weed whacker. In fact, I would prefer them. I'd feel like it would be better be using a big blade rather than a weed whacker, which is a piece of plastic twine that just spins really fast. So here's the thoroughly modern riddle. I'm starting to read. What links the battery in your smartphone with a dead yak floating down a Tibetan river? The answer is lithium, the reactive alkali metal that powers our phones, tablets, laptops, and electric cars. Electric cars, I swear. In May 2016, hundreds of protesters threw dead fish onto the streets of Tangong, a town on the eastern edge of the Tibetan Plateau. They had plucked them from the river of the Liqui River, where a toxic chemical leak from the Guangzhou Rongong lithium mine had wreaked havoc with the local ecosystem. Insert Free Tibet rhetoric here. These are pictures of masses of dead fish on the surface of the stream. Some eyewitnesses report seeing cow and yak carcasses floating there as well, dead from drinking contaminated water. It was the third such incident in the space of 7 years in an area which has seen a sharp rise in mining activity, including operations run by BYD, the world's biggest supplier of lithium-ion batteries for smartphones and electric cars and probably 100 other products. After the second incident in 2013, officials closed the mine, but when it reopened in 2016, the fish started dying again. Lithium-ion batteries are a crucial component of efforts to clean up the planet. The battery of a Tesla Model S has about 12 kilograms of lithium in it, while grid storage solutions, also sold by Tesla or others, are just said, you know, whenever like battery storage is mentioned, I just think about the tons of lithium needed and basically the massive ecological damage that has to be done elsewhere and in America. Demand for lithium is increasing exponentially, and it could double in price between 2016 and 2018, which has already passed, so it probably has already. According to a consultancy, Karen Energy Research Advisors, the lithium-ion battery is expected to grow from 100 gigawatt hours to an annual production of 800 by 2027. William Adams, head of research at Metal Bulletin, says the current spike in demand can be traced back to 2015 when the Chinese government announced a huge push towards electric vehicles in its 13th five-year plan. That's central planning that they got. That has led to a massive rise in the number of projects to extract lithium, and there are hundreds more in the pipeline. But here's the problem. There's a problem. As the world scrambles to replace it, the environmental impact of finding all this lithium required to enable that transformation could become a serious issue. One of the biggest environmental problems caused by our endless hunger. Oh yes, we're just so hungry for it. Hungry for convenience, I suppose. For the latest and smartest devices is the growing mineral crisis, particularly those needed to make our batteries. So whenever there's a tech conference or whatever, it's just like, my first thought runs to, what does this cost? Not just in terms of dollars in my bank account, but where does all this stuff come from? Who mines it? How is it mined? It'd be interesting. And so, and all the people buying this tech, you know, they think they're being socially conscious and environmentally conscious. They're not. They're as ignorant as anyone. And I wonder if we can even have a future with the laptop in front of me, with the phone in my pocket. I'm trying to prepare myself mentally for the day while I will be forced to give these things up. And I'm almost kind of having this one more mentality, almost, and again, a type of addiction, I guess, but more like, okay, this phone should be my last phone, the last phone I need to buy, because in, say, 5 or 10 years, I should be in a place, I should be thinking about, where does my life need to be, where does our society need to be, where we don't need these technologies anymore, where we can either replace them with a low-energy, low-material substitution, or not need this tech at all. But let's be generous with ourselves and say that we can have substitutions, that we can make a laptop without lithium or without the rare earths, without the rare metals from China. And maybe with the trade war and everything that is going on, maybe the industry will shift that way. But that's a decision they're making right now, and they're making it without us, whether we want it or not. But I guess that's the beauty of the market, that they can react to these problems and devise solutions. But, oh man, I wish they were found beforehand. In South America, the biggest problem is water. The continent's lithium triangle, which covers parts of Argentina, Bolivia, and Chile, holds more than half the world's supply of metal beneath an otherworldly salt flat. It's also one of the driest places on Earth. That's a real issue because this mining takes a lot of water and thus hurts any farmers in the area that grow quinoa and other basically food for themselves. So this article keeps going, but I think you get the gist of the problem. I'm going to move on to transportation in the next hour, and which will incorporate some of what I've already said. As far as whenever electric cars are mentioned, I'm just going to like do some kind of verbal eye roll, as I have been doing. As far as like, what do we need to do to solve the climate crisis? So I'm going to go to the mid-show break, and hope you are well. This is the Three Left Show, your leftist place for news and analysis for going in a different direction.
Hello, helicopter, are you here to stay? Bodies rest in motion, fighting night and day. Well, it's kill or be killed, and one day we'll get the best of them. Hello, helicopter, will you be my friend? Will you take me away?
Nobody seems to care.
let's kill or be killed, and one day we'll get the best of them. Hello, helicopter, are you listening?
Welcome back to the Three Left Show. That was Motion City's soundtrack with Hello, Helicopter. Song that definitely shares what I'm feeling. Can we ever stop pretending? Makes sense. So, in that regard, let's move on to transportation issues. Cars and mass transit. I have a number of stories that fit very nicely together. The first one is, as I usually do, a statement of the problem. And why am I outraged? I'm going to start by, first, if you're just joining me, this is the Three Left Show, a leftist reading hour where I cover a number of stories linked together based on the themes of ecology, socialism, or anarchism. Three lefts, three tendencies, just general leftism, blending them together, as well as covering the issues of our time, the curious or the committed. A statement of the problem of our transportation system. So I want to state two things here. First, an anecdote of one of the radicalizing moments of my life where I started really questioning the preconceived narratives and myths of our society. I was doing a research paper on how suburbia formed because as an architecture major, I wanted to understand the policies and the ways our cities develop and understand things. I had a goal with college that I would not form my own opinions until I had at least as confident an understanding as I could of how things work. And what I found was that highway system and car culture was not this individual market choice of consumers, as the narratives might lead you to believe. It was deliberate state and corporate lobbying of the state policy to build the highways, to zone the land for sprawl development. It was something that was maybe an outgrowth of how things were in America at the time and are now still. But none of that is an individual choice. So when that kind of attitude was shattered, I had to question everything. Everything about market economics and, oh, maybe we do need, you know, look, I'm not a full socialist, you know, I'm still liberal, or rather, as far as healthcare, that should be a commodity, but shoes should still be a commodity, a product to be bought and sold. I wasn't so sure about that anymore, because our transportation certainly is a commodity to be bought and sold, but it shouldn't be. It's a collective issue. So to ride that home with some details, this article that I have here, who's publishing it? Oh, yes, it's the Detroit Free Press. And it's called Death on Foot, America's Love of SUVs is Killing Pedestrians. Now, I thought the rise of SUV buying and had actually ebbed away, but actually it has not. So America's love of SUVs is killing pedestrians, and federal safety regulators have known this for years. Written by Eric Lawrence and Nathan Balmley and Christy Tanner of the Detroit Free Press. Team effort. So it starts with an anecdote. Robert and Karen Bota, married 50 years, explored all seven continents as they charged into their 70s. They did a lot of air travel. So Amy Bonifine didn't worry, but that does not mean they deserved being killed by an SUV when they were in Phoenix. One of the hardest things to see was her in a casket. So, a personal story there. A Ford Explorer driven by 27-year-old Alex Bradshaw hopped a curb and hit them as they stood on a sidewalk. Nowhere is safe for a pedestrian in a car culture. Both 60, they were also struck by the SUV as they walked toward the corner of a marked crosswalk. Patty Lou died immediately. Ronald died later. Four deaths highlighted the growing danger for America's most vulnerable road users. Death by SUV. The Detroit Free Press, which is part of the USA Today network, apparently, Their investigation found that the SUV revolution, God, that's a strange way of using the word revolution, is a key leading cause of the escalating pedestrian deaths nationwide, which are up 46%, nearly 50% since 2009. They've been going up. Almost 6,000 pedestrians died on or along U.S. roads in 2016 alone, which I guess is the year this was published. Nearly as many Americans have died in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, just to compare. Their investigation also found that federal safety regulations have known for years that SUVs, with their higher front end profile, they're taller, are at least twice as likely as cars to kill walkers, joggers, or children when they hit them. Yet they have done little to reduce these deaths or publicize the danger. A federal proposal to factor pedestrians into vehicle safety ratings has stalled with opposition from some automakers. Now, this is also during the Obama years, not just Trump. The rising tide of pedestrian deaths is primarily an urban plague that kills minorities at a disproportionate rate. It is more prominent in cities both in the industrialized heartland and warm weather spots in the nation's coasts, like in the Sun Belt, Detroit, Newark, New Jersey, St. Louis, etc. Vehicle safety measures, which the federal government says could save hundreds of pedestrian lives. If the yearly death rate, oh, I'm sorry, no, sorry, it was 6,000 over a number of years. And if we put in, if we try to regulate the market, we could save a few hundred. Ugh. Along with automakers, cities can take action to save pedestrians. New York City, for example, cut such deaths nearly by half in 4 years. This was called their Zero Initiative for zero pedestrian deaths. The need for steps such as lower speed limits, mid-block crosswalks, and better lighting grows in urgency as automakers move strongly towards truck and SUV production. So based on the buying preferences of convenience of buying SUVs, and one of the comments of the story was that, like, someone said, like, yeah, whenever I see someone driving an SUV, they look scared, like it's too much vehicle for them, like it's harder to control. And I live that. And it takes a lot more fuel, but it's also a matter of, like, it takes more acceleration to get them moving, which means you have to basically be moving faster to be moving, or to keep moving, keep momentum. And that's less safe. But here he is. SUV sales topped, meaning they overtook sedans, in 2014. Pickups and SUVs now account for 60% of new vehicle sales. Ford recently announced plans to discontinue the U.S. sales of most passenger cars, as Fiat Chrysler has already done so, meaning they only sell SUVs. Wow. Now, it might seem obvious that a larger vehicle can cause more damage in a crash, whether to a smaller car or an unprotected skull, but for some researchers, trust me, wearing a helmet doesn't help, have been hesitant to assign blame for the spike of pedestrian deaths on America's love of SUVs, in part because various factors are at play. Oh, we can't just blame it on one thing, but it is statistically the only thing in common. So, it was 6,000, near 6,000 deaths in 1 year. Okay, and these are deaths. Now, the casualty rate, and it goes into this, of all traffic-related injuries and deaths is over 30,000. And it was 37,000. It's actually gone up a little bit. Mostly because, I guess, more people are driving. Less people are driving during the recession, at least when it's at its height. And people are just driving at Bush-era levels now. So thus, the casualty rate has gone up. Many who died were males, were jaywalking, or had alcohol in their system. This is referring to the federal data in 2016. They were next to multi-lane roads in urban areas at night. Some might have been distracted, just as the vehicle drivers could have been distracted. But the data is lacking to quantify distraction as a cause. Some of these other factors also saw increases in recent years, but the SUV component is what stands out. Key factors consistently backed by data is a growing involvement in higher profile blunt-nosed SUVs. And then the next section goes into safety standards being stalled. Data, basically there's a piece of tech where, like automatic braking, so that there's a sensor in the car and a radar, And if it if there's something that is in front of it, the brakes will engage. But this only works at slower speeds. And so it will save a few hundred lives out of the 6,000. Wow, we're great. And again, it's a regulate. Have a technical solution. The solution isn't that we need less driving, less SUVs, and so on. And we could regulate them out, regulate that cars actually have to be smaller, that they have to be safer. And that, as early as 2001, researchers at Rowan University, New Jersey, predicted a deadly trend that could reverse a historic drop in pedestrian fatalities. Now they are as high as they were since the George Bush administration. Quote, in the U.S., passenger vehicles are shifting from a fleet populated primarily by cars to a fleet dominated by light trucks and vans, according to the research paper. Light trucks, which include SUVs. Because light trucks are heavier, stiffer, and geometrically more blunt, they pose a dramatically higher threat. They also have more power, and thus they're always going faster. It goes into the what could be common sense by this point, but the fatality of a being hit goes up exponentially with each 10 miles per hour. So at 20, 5% pedestrians die in a crash. 30, 45%. At 40 miles per hour, it goes up to 85%. Thus, lowering speed limits to between 20 to 30 is the best thing in urban areas. But still, 5% die. I prefer no one die. And that means that we can't accept that there have to be cars. And we'll get into that, which is something this article never does. Now, overall, traffic fatalities have dropped as more safety equipment's being put into cars and such. Pedestrian deaths are not a new phenomenon. It goes into the history. And it's kind of unnecessary. Let's move on. There's no safety measures, but in the industry, you don't want to spend the money on it. Goes into automatic braking. Explain that. There's European standards on safety. It's all just very milquetoast to me because it's not addressing the major problem, which is people are getting hit by these large machines that are just generally not well controlled. So let's move on. And this is a good transition here. Good segue over then into that it's a car problem, not just an SUV problem. But that article was good because it gave the stats on how many people are in fact getting killed every year. Okay, so like compared to gun deaths, it's multiple times gun deaths. But are we having national conversations about car fatalities all the time? Well, in New York City, it's an issue. In major metropolitan areas, it's an issue. But it's not getting the attention it deserves because with guns, you just pass a ban or a regulation or whatever. It doesn't cost that much, at least to the government. If it's about traffic fatalities, at the very least, one of the milquetoast solutions, and I do consider it milquetoast, is all of the safety improvements of the infrastructure to make it safer to cross the roads, to be safer around cars, right? But you don't need all this pedestrian safety crap if there's just less driving. Less driving, less harm. Less pollution, less harm. Less technology, less need for harmful mining. So this is from BBC News. So the next few stories, I think, will, just like before, when it comes to good reporting on this stuff, all the good stories seem to come from Europe or elsewhere. Maybe because their government actually subsidizes media and it subsidizes science in a way that our country just doesn't. Title, Electric Cars Will Not Solve Transport Problem, Report Warns. This is by Roger Harabin, a BBC environment analyst, published very recently, July 5th. A report in the UK warns that electrifying cars is not going to address traffic jams, urban sprawl, and wasted space for parking. No duh. The Center for Research into Energy Demand Solutions, acronym CREDS, the report calls on the government to devise a strategy allowing people to have a good standard of living without needing a car. Just as we should have a good standard of living without requiring rare metals that need to be, we need to poison rivers. The government said it was spending $2 billion to promote walking and cycling only, but it also plans to spend $50 billion on improving roads. However, critics accuse the government of not having a serious plan to deal with the social problems associated with mass car ownership. CREZ is an academic consortium of more than 80 academics across the UK. Car use is a massive blind spot on government policy, Professor Julian Anable, one of the authors of the report, said. She added, for many years, ministers have adopted the principle of trying to meet demand by increasing road space. What they need to do is reduce demand instead. But what about people who depend on their cars? The authors say that there will always be people that depend, especially in the countryside or suburbs. And the disabled can also be added to that group. But they point out that many young people in cities are choosing not to buy cars. Instead, they're using public transport, walking, cycling, taking mini cabs, and hiring cars when they are needed. I myself am part of that. This more active lifestyle means less obesity, pollution, and road danger, and greater sociability as people meet their neighbors on their way to work. It also allows parking spaces to be liberated for more housing and gardens, or gardens. The government offers say should be encouraging other people to follow the lead set by the young. It is a happy accident. Car ownership is static in every age group except over 60. The government should build on that. Strengthen the center. And by center, I just mean like a thing. How could we help people live without cars? Is a question. She maintains car ownership is wasteful because cars are parked 98% of their lifetime, with a third of cars not going out every day. Once you own a car, though, she says, there is a compelling temptation to use it even for simple journeys. This goes double for Uber and other ride sharing. But it is really expensive investment. If people do not have their cars, they can spend on money on other things. Once people start to live without a car, they wonder why they even wanted one in the first place. A car is so much of a hassle. Now, I've yet to own a car in my life, and this is because I've listened to other people and the hassles they have. So here is something. And I'm going to condense this graph here. It's between 2006 and 2016, so a 10-year period, of the growth or change in costs on per week. So the costs of a car are about £55 a week in the UK. The cost weekly of using public transport is £15. 55 versus 15. That is the difference in spending. And that's probably similar to the U.S. They should also incentivize local councils, this would be municipal government, to build housing developments that are easy to access without a car. They would also benefit the 25% of households that do not have cars at all. But won't electric cars be a good thing? Says a passive voice again. So, the report supports government efforts to phase out petrol and diesel cars and towards that net zero emissions, but it says the timetable is too slow and may not even be achieved anyway. I already covered why earlier this episode. There is a huge challenge in charging vehicles, especially in urban areas with no off-street parking. What is more, drivers tend to be choosing hybrid vehicles rather than pure electric ones, and that will lock in fossil fuel usage into the future. This goes for any technology. Okay? Locks it in. Locks in the fact that we're not actually transitioning off of dirty energy. Will driverless cars help? The other great technological change underway may be that on the roads is a driverless car. The report warns, though, that this dream could also turn sour. I suggest it will. As car owners may choose to live many miles from their workplace, which, by the way, they already do with car culture. They choose, or rather, have the ability to live far away and use their car as a mobile office while sitting in traffic jams that they have helped to create. Now, the improvement of the driverless car will not to change anything except that when you have your hour, 40-minute, half-hour commute, you'll be able to do other things. Joy of joys. Well, guess what? You can do that on mass transit. You can sit and read or cover things or make a phone call, supposing you are using an indoor voice. See, the AA, and I guess that's the Automotive Association or something, President Edmund King, agrees electric driverless vehicles could make congestion worse. He told us, one vision of hell is that of the driverless car turns up in the city center where there is no parking. To quote him, the occupant gets out to do their business while the car just continues driving around for hours on end until beckoned back by the user. He suggests, perhaps, switching the vehicle taxation away from gas and diesel and onto the road miles, charge per miles you drive, which would be imposed electronically. So to have like a government-mandated sensor in the car, which it could be sabotaged. Just not have cars, you know? It's but this is a automotive guy, so. But yeah, that just... And it's weird that some Tech Valley people actually say this is a good thing that the car circles the block. You don't have to circle the block anymore. You just get out. How convenient. And the car just circles around looking for parking forever without you. Or actually, no. I'm thinking of when they're talking about driverless vehicles that aren't owned by anyone, and then they're going just to the next person who... But they would still drive around looking for parking or something until they're summoned by the next person. Which may be less time, but it's still frickin' waste. And it's creating congestion. How are people reacting to the report? I like this part. A spokesperson for the Department of Transport said, "We are committed to future-proofing our towns and cities." Which, by the way, you can't really do. You can only have an adaptive posture. Which, by the way, depending on driverless vehicles, is not future-proofing. And saying, we've got to get ahead of this and assume that that's going to be where things are going. Holy moly, that scares the hell out of me. When local office holders are like, you know, yeah, we need to prepare for this. Let's see. He says, this year we launched the biggest regulatory review in a generation to ensure we are ready to take advantage of new technologies which can help achieve this. Now, again, focus on technology and new technology rather than less, because there can't possibly be less. We have to have growth. We are also helping more people choose cleaner, greener forms of transport by investing around $2 billion in active travel over the course of this parliament, meaning legislative session. Now, again, so this spokesperson kind of frames $2 billion as being, look at how much we're spending. But it's still a minute fraction of what is spent on improving, quote-unquote improving, or rather spending on roads and car infrastructure. This is bad. We need to transition from all the spending we do on roads and highways. We'll just start with highway spending. Local roads and urban roads, fine, it's streets. They should be filling potholes. But transition that to funding mass transit. And $2 billion, it's just not fast enough. You know, it's like, unless it's like $2 billion this year, then $5 billion next year, and $10 billion, and then it's a plan, and we'll phase out spending on highways. But that is not happening. In New York, it's like, we'll decide what to do with our highways here in Albany in 30 years, because that's the next time that they're going to have to rehab them. They just finished rehabbing them, which means they're good for another 30 years. Another 30 years of basically depending on having a car system in my city. When I went to this public meeting and heard these bureaucrats talk, it was so nauseous. And it gives me nausea just thinking about it. Last quote, and I'll finish up this piece. But Labour's Lillian Greenwood, chair of the Commons Transport Committee, so this is the Mass Transit Committee, believes ministers must do more. She said, and you can imagine your own British accent, "The move to electric vehicles is most definitely not a panacea and fails to address wider concerns about public health and the kinds of places where we want to live. Congestion is a costly blight on many urban areas, and there is a real risk that we will end up swapping dirty, polluting traffic jams for clean, green ones. Inactivity and obesity are increasingly serious public health problems. Getting people out of their cars is essential, yet the government has no targets, no goals for such a shift. My committee has called for that to change. Labour's Lillian Greenwood, I salute you." Okay. So to build on that, as mentioned in that article, young people are driving slightly less. Now, let's explore that a little further. From CityLab. "Millennials love transit most. Boomers still stuck on cars." Written by Sarah Goodyear. Written September of 2014. So this is a few years old now. But it was a study at that time. And trust me, social studies are few and far between. So you gotta take what you can get. "A new study shows generations bucking their upbringings, with sheltered millennials choosing the bus." What is that meant by that? In 2013, transit ridership in the U.S. hit a 50-year high, with the nation's transit systems logging 10.7 billion rides. Now, I want to mention that there's kind of an asterisk here. Some of that transit ridership has now been hit by the growth of ride-sharing. A new survey from the new transportation-focused philanthropy Transit Center seeks to discover who those riders are and what motivates them to get on trains, buses, and streetcars. Streetcars. But some cities have been building them. Toronto, I believe, is basically ditching buses and putting a streetcar network on tracks. The answer, according to Who's On Board 2014 Mobility Attitude Survey, transit riders are disproportionately young, members of ethnic minorities, and most important of all, they live in relatively dense neighborhoods where high-quality transit is available. If it's there, it's used. The most important factor for them in choosing transit is travel time, reliability, not fancier amenities such as Wi-Fi. I think there's this thing where like buses, like, we can compete with ride-sharing by having Wi-Fi. No, it just needs to be there. The survey, which gathered data from 11,842 respondents in 46 metropolitan areas, so they did focus on that, found that the generational divide over transit that many observers have noted over the past few years is real. People under 30 are far more likely to ride public transport and express positive feelings about it than older people, regardless of what part of the country they live in and what kind of neighborhood they grew up in. The survey looked at five areas, the South, Southwest, West Coast, Midwest, and classified as traditional cities, which included cities with mature and widely used transit system, which included San Fran, Boston, Philadelphia, New York, and D.C. In these traditional cities, 43% of people under 30, you know, quite a lot, reported riding transit at least once a week, compared with the 12% of those between 30 and 60, and 9% over 60. That's quite a difference. Even in regions with much lower overall ridership, the trend of young people using transit more held true. 20% of those under 30 in the South, so I guess these are cities like New Orleans, say that ride transit once a week, compared with 10% of those older, and 2% over 60. So even in the South, you know, the number percentage is much lower, but it's still that gap is almost the same. The preference for transit also showed up when those under 30 had kids, suggesting that the trend isn't just about being child-free, you know, being like me, across all income brackets as well. Parents under 30 use transit significantly more than those between 30 and 60. And 45%, nearly half, of this under 30 parent group had incomes more than $75,000, which is like the amount you actually need to be statistically happy, said they use transit weekly compared to the 16% of the parents over 30 or 60 in the same income bracket. Interestingly, these same young people reported being raised in disproportionately auto-centric environments. They were less likely to have been encouraged to walk or bike by their families as children or would have had easy access to transit, and were more likely to have gotten the message from parents that transit was unsafe or uncool. Still, they express disproportionately transit-friendly attitudes, even as their elders are continuing to reject transit options. In the words of the researchers, quote, "The millennial generation seems to be defying its sheltered suburban upbringing by delaying the acquisition of a driver's license and choosing transit. Meanwhile, baby boomers who grew up using transit and were encouraged to do so are defying their upbringing by avoiding it now." Why? Another key finding is that many respondents say they would like to live in a different kind of neighborhood than they do now, meaning a more denser one. So nearly two-thirds, 58%, said that they would like to live in a neighborhood with a mix of residential, blah, 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 mixed use. But that didn't mean the respondents wanted to leave the suburbs. That figure combines those with preferences for urban, suburban, as well as small-town mixed-use neighborhoods. Merely, it's just that people didn't want the completely separated uses of suburban land use. That was imposed by planning departments who had a really terrible methodology. Why was it bad? It was mechanical, to put it very simply. A mechanical worldview that doesn't see the connections between things. Other key points from the survey. Respondents were five times more likely to take transit if they were offered a pre-tax commuting benefit from the employer. Transit use varied widely by race and ethnicity. 99% of African Americans, blacks, reported using transit at least once a week, as did 37% of Hispanics, 32% First Nation, Natives, 18% Asian, just 10% white. White people. Ugh. In general, transit use decreased as income increased, but respondents in the highest bracket, and by the way, again, this is talking about metropolitan areas. This is areas where it's available, and most importantly, it's convenient. People take, usually, the most convenient option. So, it really is just a question of what's more convenient. And the market is going to make profit-making and destruction more convenient. Or rather, sorry, it's what is convenient. It's convenient to just pollute a river rather than have an industrial process that doesn't harm the environment, right? It is more convenient to drive, or is more convenient to build, at the time, I suppose, to build a car-based transportation system. In general, transit use decreased as income increased. But respondents in the highest bracket, that's 150,000 and up, reported riding transit more than any other group. So it's actually like in the extremes. So when you're poor, you use transit more, and when you're very rich, you use transit more. I don't sure what explains that. But I think it's maybe like a middle class mentality of like, I need to have status symbols. Once you're rich enough and you have FU money, it's like, yeah, I'll take the subway too. What of it? I'm gonna be wearing my $5,000 suit and my briefcase, and yeah, flaunt it. Concern for the environment ranked last among reasons to use transit across all age groups. So that suggests what I've said. Just it's accessibility, it's convenience. So this also, as a urban design person and architecture nerd, this suggests to me that the future of American development, denser and more built up suburbs. And that is a trend that is visible in my area, as some new development is happening in my city core of Albany, but in our suburbs, like Clifton Park, as people who first moved there a generation or so ago are aging, but not in need of being nursing home, they want to drive less. That means that the area known as Clifton Park, we call it there because you park a car there. That's a joke. That they want to be able to walk around, right? But they don't want to move to the city where all the black people are. So build up the suburbs. And that seems to be like where things might be heading. And that might be positive if all of these built up suburbs can then be really like super interconnected with bus lines, which I think the regional transit network, which is good that we already have the infrastructure to kind of just build that out and have more lines between all these areas as the center of these suburbs where, like, say where the highway meets. Running out of time, but I'll go through this one fast. The next story is about the social stigma of using public transport. So just to summarize it, in quote unquote Western or Anglophone countries, they use the word Anglophone, which is a very useful term because then you're referring to Australia, New Zealand, England, and America. Public transit use attitudes are relatively neutral, rather in the city of Brisbane they looked at. But in countries that are kind of up and coming, developing, and competing with Anglophone countries, China and India, it is frowned upon to use public transport. And so as we're exporting our, in our globalized culture, we're also exporting car culture and kind of going through the same thing as in the 50s, where it's like, if you didn't own a car, you were a loser. You're not going to be able to get a date. You're not going to like, you're a loser. You're like, only losers have to take mass transit. You have to be poor. And that's an attitude I'm sure many Americans still have. And so it suggests, it's not a long piece, that there are these cultural barriers and that attitudes need to shift over time, and that urban planners need to be thinking about those attitudes, not just a matter of if we provide it, they will come. You could make transit very convenient, but if there is still these stigmas, these attitudes, that can hamstring that effort. And on a personal note, I hear from usually women that, you know, I used the bus once, but there was a creep on the bus, and now I'll never use it again. I kind of like, how long ago was that? You know, and again, it's a matter of being mass transit. The more people there are, the more likely there will be someone who will step up and say, when like, hey, creep, can you stop that? Or just support women, you know, and have safe spaces. When it is just people who can't afford any other type of transportation taking the bus, yes, then I guess it's dangerous. But yeah, like the attitude that it was a Musk had, that's like, oh, I don't want to use the bus. People, serial killers use the bus. It was ridiculous. It was rightfully panned via social media and whatnot. But it was emblematic that he is in fact representing a very sizable demographic of Americans who think that only dangerous people take the bus. That has to change. And that changes by us actually, the safe person being on the bus. And then if you see something bad, someone acting creepy, or someone with mental health problems, to help out with that, to be a compassionate human being in public mass transit. Now, trains had a better view because they are more expensive than buses, especially in America. Yeah. So in the last story, now go to like, what do we really need to do? And with my theme of we just need less driving, less cars, and just to reverse course and just actively take out the highways and replace them with like big bus boulevards. And well, guess what? Here's a story from Vice. It's titled Why Helsinki, that's the capital of Finland, is tearing up its freeways, produced by Ariel Durmain Ross, published April of this year. And it's a video.
This week, New York State approved America's very first congestion pricing policy, forcing drivers to pay at least $10 to access Manhattan below 60th Street. The policy has two big benefits. First, the toll should generate about $1 billion earmarked for New York's ailing public transportation system. And congestion pricing schemes have also proven to reduce the number of cars on streets. Fewer cars means less emissions.
60th Street, also for context, is the southern edge of Central Park, which isn't south enough for my taste. Being someone who lived in New York City, I think it should be 110th, which is the northern edge of Central Park. But it's a compromise. That's where Midtown starts.
A notable achievement, given that cars and trucks are responsible for 1/5 of all U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. But if the world is going to get serious about reducing emissions, it needs more than congestion pricing. It needs to go full Helsinki.
Driving in a highway inside the city in the 21st century is like smoking in the 20th century. Now we know that it's not healthy.
Yeah.
Once we did it, but now we know better.
Carlos Lemuela came to Helsinki from his native Spain in 2007 to study urban design and architecture. In his master's thesis, he reimagined the city of Helsinki by demolishing one of the city's major freeways and building affordable housing and shops in its place.
When you look at a freeway, do you find it useful?
Well, I think that freeways are infrastructure that belongs to the past, to a time when we didn't know anything about climate change, about the effects that the pollution has on health. So, no, I don't think that a freeway is useful inside a city. Cities are for people, and people need different means of transportation, but the cars shouldn't be the one element that dictates how a city is built.
Today, Lemuela's thesis is the basis for a major infrastructure project, which aims to grow the city's population by 40% in a way that's carbon neutral. To make room for new residents, Helsinki plans to invest in public transport and tear up three of the city's major freeways, replacing them with thinner roads bounded by boulevards of affordable housing and shops. Helsinki's original plan was even more ambitious. It wanted to redevelop all seven of its freeways, but a court ruled that that would be too disruptive to traffic. So the city will start with three. For Ani Sinimaki, the city's deputy mayor for urban environment, the project isn't about banning cars. It's trying to get people to see the benefits of giving up their cars voluntarily.
So by 2050, owning a car in Helsinki is going to be pretty inconvenient and pretty slow. Is that the general idea?
General idea that is more perhaps that in 2050 in Helsinki, it's super easy to use public transport.
Right. Why is this plan important?
It's a plan that tells what kind of future we do want. It lays the main goals of how we wish the city to grow. Already now, more than 3/4 of all journeys made in Helsinki are made by public transport, walking or cycling. So we are a good public transport city at the moment, but we will be even better.
Very nice, very nice. That's what we need to do. Now, Helsinki is a world-class metropolitan city, but it's possible. You just have to make the decision. I think it was a useful idea there that I wasn't aware of. A deputy mayor of the environment. So, I think other large metropolitan areas have deputy mayors, but imagine, like, maybe a city my size, which is 100,000 people. We just have one mayor who's, like, basically in charge of everything. And it's really inefficient. Like, she can't divide her time to everything. Shouldn't. I think there should be deputy mayors. There should be a deputy mayor of the streets and a deputy mayor of the economic development. So, yeah, I'm going to wrap up the show. A reminder that word of mouth is the best thing you can do to grow this show as well as a number of like-minded people. You can leave a review of the show on all the podcast platforms where it is done, distributed. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Three Left Show. Please support the show materially. Visit the Patreon page, Three Left Show. All money given there, all that support, goes to outreach, the printing of material, the buying of Facebook ads, so on. And maybe the buying of better equipment. So let's say when I get to 5 members, I will buy myself a better mic. But, you know, I'm using community radio equipment. So it would be for producing extra content at home, thus extra content that could be then offered as, bonuses for being a subscriber. Links for all of the articles used will be put in the show description, but all episodes in the are archived on the website 3lefts.news, nothing else, which is the full backlog. So I am been your host for this edition of the 3 Left Show, your friendly social justice warrior in training. So thank you very much, be well, and take what has been said to heart. Get serious, be active, think collectively. All right. Be well, everybody.